I'm Christy Hornby, Chair of VIPA Victoria's Risk Community of Practice, and I'm an Associate Director at Grosvenor, a management consultancy. Firstly, before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people and pay my respect to their elders past, present and emerging. I recognise their continued connection to the land and waters of this beautiful place and acknowledge that they never ceded sovereignty. I extend that respect to my own community, all traditional owners of the lands and any First Nations people who may listen to this recording. I had the pleasure of being part of the panel discussion at IPA Victoria's AI and the Future of Governance event on Wednesday, 25th of October at Deloitte. Over 150 professionals across the public purpose sector attended the informative and interactive event and heard from an exceptional lineup of experts who delved into the emerging risks and opportunities that AI presents for the sector. This is the second episode of the podcast series that focuses on the audience's unanswered questions, and it's my pleasure to interview Peter Williams, who I met on the day, who will share his insights, reflections and wise words about all things AI. Pete is the Chief Edge Officer at Deloitte Centre for the Edge Australia and the Chairman of Deloitte Australia's Innovation Council. A recognised thought leader and practitioner in innovation, Pete started working with Internet Technologies in 1993 and founded an e-business consulting group, Deloitte Australia, in 1996. Since that time, he's been the CEO of the Eclipse Group, a Deloitte subsidiary, and a founder of Deloitte Digital. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Christy. Hi. Good to catch up again.
So for those that didn't attend the AI and Future of Governance event, can you tell us a bit more about your background, Pete?
Yeah, so I'm actually an accountant and I worked for maybe, I'm in my 40th year at Deloitte. So, but when I started, I worked in the area of, you know, insolvency, company doctor sort of guy. So had a lot to do with, it's very regulatory driven and, you know, liquidations, receiverships, bankruptcies. So I got a really good exposure to the legal side of things and procedure and all that sort of stuff. But I got seconded to the UK in 1993 and I went on the internet for the first time because hearing about this information superhighway and had absolutely no idea what that meant. And I went on the internet for the first time. I thought, my God, this is going to change everything. And that's what I'm going to do from now on. So, you know, I came back to Australia, said to the guys, let's start an e-business consulting group. And they were like, what's that? And I'm like, it's to do with the internet. And they're like, what's that? And it's like, don't worry, it's going to be bigger than electricity. Let's just back me. And I've worked in it ever since. And really, I suppose my vision at the time was that this notion that suddenly the world's information and our ability to access services and software was going to change, that we wouldn't have to be physically in a place or have physical access to information. So, I'm just happy that my vision's played out. And it was, to me, I saw this fundamental change in how we'd live our lives and how things would happen, and just turned out that I was right.
Yeah, how wonderful. And, you know, 30 years this year as well, Pete, going from, you know, the evolution of that technology when you would have started as an accountant and doing that work, I imagine there would have been a lot of hand ledgers and lots of paper, to now the insights that you can gather. It truly is that information superhighway, as you said.
Yeah, and it's sort of interesting that, you know, this whole technology is going to take our jobs. Well, it's almost like, no, technology is not going to take your job, because my job wasn't to write things up neatly into, you know, numbers. My job was to be able to present information to managers and people in the business to be able to understand what was going on. It just that a lot of the work related to do that had to be hand compiled. And if I wanted to do a prediction and you had like 12 column forecasts and stuff, like, oh, let's change that assumption. You know, the rubber would be out. You'd have to change everything all over the place. So, So understand that when these new tools come in, it's not your job that goes, but it's the sort of, you focus on the true meaning of the work that you do.
And you've hit the nail on the head there as well, because there's naturally a lot of discussion about the emergence of generative AI. So algorithms like ChatGPT that create new content and what that ability might mean for the public sector. So in your mind and with all the experience you've got, what do you think are those particular challenges and opportunities that generative AI creates for the public sector? You know, what tools might it want to use, but what areas might need to be regulated?
So I think the first thing is to flip back to purpose and to understand what's really going on here. So what the internet or the web meant was that we could access information in the form that it was published. Now, all of us have gone to government websites and, you know, the Victorian government website has this been helpful? Sometimes it's a thumbs up, many times it's a thumbs down, because I didn't actually want that context. I was looking for this. So if you flip that and say it allows us to access information in the context that we're after, in the language that we speak and in words that we understand, well, that means, hey, can you explain the my aged care system to me in Vietnamese, because I need to do some work with my grandmother who English is a second language. Can you make that less formal and put it in conversational Vietnamese? Yes, I can. So, and again, so we've spent a lot of time in the public sector, you know, translating things, but it doesn't always work. And we know that, you know, if you meet somebody English as a second language to an Aussie, it's like, gee, they speak really formally. So again, we can set the tone. So I think it's this sort of notion of, in a world where people can access the information they need in their context, I still will be publishing and providing that information, but I can provide tools that help them understand and get the government information given to them in a way that they can ingest and action. The next side of it is that whilst we're seeing, you know, most people who are using it are probably using it, ChatGPT, as some form of maybe advanced search, it's really the ability to build a conversation. And, you know, can you guide me through and provide me a step-by-step process to help my elderly aunt understand what how the my aged care system works? And, you know, so I actually did this recently, and it was like, I'm reading through the booklet and I'm like, I just wish I had ChatGPT. It's like, what, you know, how do you organize the co-payment? That's what I wanted to know, but I had to wade through a book. So I think it's this sort of notion of, we can actually provide access to services in a far better way, in a way that it puts less confusion and fear and unhappiness into the citizens, but also makes our work easier. So, yeah, so that's the that to me is the way I see it. And it's interesting. The only government I've seen it, and it's probably not the most political correct thing to say, but the Russian government's service portal is generative AI. It's fantastic. So not everything they do is great, but it's the first government one that I've seen. And increasingly I'm seeing organisations do that internally. So again, your own policy handbooks or your intranets. Hey, what's our leave? You know, how much notice do I have to give for leave, and what's my leave balance? Because what we can also do with generative AI is say, hey, the first part of that prompt or question was a policy question. The second part is go up, and I know it's Christy or Pete who's asking this question. Let's go into the HR system and say, hey, Pete, you've got 15 days leave left. And you have to give 3 weeks' notice, but you can negotiate with that manager. Oh, cool. So not only is it the content that it generates, it's the way that we'll interact with software in the future will be conversational, rather than having to know where the menu is and where the system is and where this bit is that. So, yeah, I find it exciting. In terms of what do we need to regulate, there's a level of risk around hallucination. And the way that we're dealing with it in the broader scheme is that we're sort of creating and putting these policies together, and we're just hammering it with questions, with people who've got expertise, thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs up, thumbs down. Hey, clearly there's this piece of information missing. The other side of it is a thing called temperature. Sorry, this is a bit technical, but let's take the example of, you know, we both do consulting work and we're responding to a government tender and it says, what's your policy on modern slavery? Well, I don't want, you know, the large language model to, every time I respond to a tender, generate a new modern slavery policy based upon what it feels like today. I want it to go and extract from the policy documents and then give that back in the form that it is. So you can set it up as a compose something new or help me with an idea. Or you can set it up is go find what that policy is and bring it back to me and say, based on your question, this is the answer. So in terms of regulation, I don't know. I've sort of thought about it a bit. It's a bit, I think the main thing is we know it's not always going to be perfect. It will get better over time. But, it's sort of like regulate it so it's honest, that it's safe, that it's transparent. But at this point, I don't think you can regulate something to say it has to be 100% accurate perfectly all the time, because that's not the world we live in. I don't know. What do you think, Kirsty? Have you thought much about that side of it?
Yeah, I think dealing with the nature of the technology that we are, the horse is already bolted. So, a point that we discussed at the panel a few weeks ago was, the wonderful capability we've got now to do diagnostic scans of people's x-rays and use that to help us determine what illness they have. And so the reason we have that technology is actually based off IP being breached in terms of lots and lots of patients' private data was uploaded, private scans were uploaded to create the training data to be able to do that. Will we walk back that amazing technology? No. But how do we manage the regulation of something so big and so complicated? I'm not sure. I might personally leave that one to the lawyers to fight over. But I really love, there was lots of words of wisdom in what you said, Pete, but I almost want to circle back to one of the first things you said, because I think there was a real nugget there in your discussion of the use of generative AI for government in sort of situating information in an individual's context. And so what that made me think when you were explaining that was governments have been on this journey over time already, right? So we've seen over time, there's all the different departments and their acronyms change every so often, and it's alphabet soup. And one day you're going to DSE for your fishing license, and then you're going to DEPI, and then you're going to DELP, and then you're going to DECA. But over time, we've seen across all jurisdictions the move to service centres and service platforms. So it's user focused. So this sounds like the next logical step for government. I guess though, to achieve that change, you need sort of executives who are comfortable with making the change and sort of moving to that environment. And this can be a technocratic domain, even some of the, concepts you just talked about of hallucinations and temperature and how to avoid bias in training data. This can all be very challenging and off-putting. So to your mind, what are some of the best ways to talk about AI issues with senior leaders who might have limited interest or knowledge in this area?
So, it is funny. I was talking about this morning to somebody, and I said, it's like being when I present this stuff all the time and working with it. It's all I do now. I'm lucky enough to be like, I haven't been this excited since I first went on the web, and I'm just pity that I'm 60 because I just think it's so profound. But it's like literally like being that magician David Copperfield. They make a train disappear. So where did that train go? How did he do that? I actually believe it's like saying to executives, let's sit down and let's talk about your industry. Let's think about the challenges. I did one with an insurance company, and I did a bit of preceding and all of that sort of stuff, but I was just prompting, talk to me about the way that the industry's changed over the last 20 years, what regulations have been. And then I got some data from APRA, uploaded it into ChatGPT Code Interpreter, and got it to produce graphs and summaries of how claims have changed and what the nature of claims was. And they were looking at me like, how is this? They were like, do you, how long have you worked in this industry? And I'm like, well, I prepared the presentation yesterday. How are you doing this? And then it was like, okay, let's teach you how to use it. So I'm a real believer in, the sort of that learning thing, like sort of tell me, I'll sort of see, show me, I'll sort of might get it, but let me. So, it's this sort of tell me, show me, let me, and then say, well, what does that mean? And how might you use this? And get them. I call it sort of like lifting the veil on people's view of themselves. So, and I do a lot of this stuff with, digital and stuff historically. I say, oh, who thinks they could design a mobile app? Well, not me, because, I'm a, a department secretary. It's like, well, let's just imagine that you use apps and you want to do one to deal with this thing, and they get together and prototype, and it's like, wow, they suddenly realize actually we do know what can be done with it. We've sort of created this artificial barrier. So my view is make it immersive or run a bit of a workshop about it, but have ChatGPT sitting there as a participant and asking questions and critiquing responses. And suddenly, the world opens up and you start to see, well, wow, it's not really a technology domain. It's a knowledge domain. And then it's a bit like, well, how do I start to create certainty and accuracy in the information I provide? And yeah, so I think, to me, it's provide an immersive experience and be comfortable as showing like, hey, this is the sort of stuff that can go wrong. And if you are doing it, I always say to people, use it in instances where you're able to validate the answer. So if you, does it sound right or wrong? And what we're actually doing a lot out there in both public and private sector is doing it through call centre agents.
Yeah, and, you know, something that's really important to me and I've found that works for me is just start, right? And that's really what you're saying too, just start and start small. So, you know, there can be this sort of technocratic, you know, seemingly inaccessible field around it. I just was quite interested in this individually. You know, I've always loved technology and always sort of wanted to ask what if, and did a philosophy major through university. So when all this started happening, I just went and read up about it. And there's so many amazing resources out there. So I love the Federal Department of Industry. They've got a couple of research and consultation and discussion papers up, which are an excellent starting point. The CSIRO has a responsible AI network that has amazing webinars and resources. So I'd really encourage everyone just to start. But I guess, you know, you've touched on a few points which are probably relevant here too. But one question we had was, what advice would you give to people working in the sector who might have to be managing suppliers who use AI, but they themselves don't have a privacy, technology or security background? How do you manage that information asymmetry?
Well, I think that goes into, you know, let's say we're dealing with suppliers and I'm not really sure about all this stuff. So I think in terms of your supply agreements and stuff, it's like, if you are using AI, you need to be transparent. You are, let's say you put out a tender, you might say, you know, you can put the tender information into AI to help you, you know, generate a response, but you are not allowed to put any of this confidential data in an AI system. So I think by sort of stepping back and saying, what information is in the public domain that would be usable? What information is in the public domain that wouldn't be usable? And what we're saying to organisations who are looking to use AI is, like, think about it in terms of right to use. So, and you need to say to suppliers, well, if you're providing the information, you know, we want to see some evidence of your right to use. We want to understand what tools you're using. We want to understand that if we're working together and you've got data that could be under a security and privacy regime. But again, I would be saying to the person in the government seat doing that stuff, call in your privacy security people and just make sure that you build it out into your supply agreements or your contracts, because the reality is, for most organisations, their contracts don't, even if it's an existing statement of work, they didn't even perceive that this might happen. And it really only happened, you know, at the end of November last year. So, yeah, just put clarity. And that's, you know, that's what I'm doing. That's what we're doing at Deloitte. And the other thing is, understand as well whether the tools that are being used for AI are external tools, like ChatGPT, you know, chat.openai.com, or is it an internal instance? So that's one of the things. You can create your own secure internal instance. So be clear about, if you are using AI, you need to be able to show us, what's the environment you're using? Is it secure? Things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Fully agree there. And I guess, you know, there's that temptation within us all to fully explore this technology, right? It's fun, it's new, it's sexy. Like, there's so many things you can do with it. You can even generate funny images or funny videos, you know, in a matter of seconds. So we're all tempted to explore with it. But, you know, I remember back when social media, you know, also sort of exploded all at once, the rule at the time was, don't put anything on there that you don't want your parent or teacher to see. You know, I think equivalently for people employed in their roles, don't put anything on that you'd expect your competitors or, you know, your stakeholders, or your minister or your boss to see, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that goes to the point, Christy. It's like, we can create our own secure instance, so provide really clear guidelines of what you can and can't do, but by the same token, quickly provision your own internal safe, secure environments and have different ways of using it. Like, you know what? You don't need to go to ChatGPT to do this stuff, because we've got the, you know, Department of
Prime Minister. Yeah, got the guardrails.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there is such a focus on the use of large language models as well with ChatGPT's, you know, explosion. So what do you see as those potential opportunities and risks in using large language models? And how would users know if an LLM has been modified with biased training data? Big question.
Yeah, it's sort of, all data is biased. Mm. You know, like if you said, you know, the large language models are going to be using everything that it can scrape off the web. So Well, what does that mean? Well, the web is probably predominantly in English, Western countries, so we'll have a bias towards that. If, say, X has created its own model and large language model off Twitter, so you can work out your own bias factors on that, or on X, not Twitter anymore. But so again, it's like, what are those data sources? And am I confident about them? The other one is like, well, is it, you may say, well, is it a standard open large language model, such as, the OpenAI one or Llama from Facebook or the Claude
Yeah,
from Anthropic?
ideal. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a whole heap of them. And have you modified, you might ask that, have you modified that? Because again, you might say, for Grosvenor Consulting, we've put in a whole heap of our IP and methodologies in there. So when we say, hey, we're going to go and have a look at the security and privacy framework of a government department, actually shape it based on a large language model together with our specialized intellectual property. Cool. Now, if somebody said to you, well, Christy, where did you get that from? You could say, hey, we're using both a large language model to compose the answer, but we're largely using our IP. So you probably, if you are working with supply, going back to that point before, well, what large language model are you using? Have you fine-tuned it? At this stage, you can create your own, but not many will. But I think the key thing to understand is that all data sets are biased in some way, but we don't always know how. But with ChatGPT and any other large language model, you can make it really biased in terms of how you deal with the prompt. So answer this. You might say, take the prompt, but always answer it in a libertarian model, or take the prompt and always answer it in a ultra conservative model or whatever. And it will do that. So understanding how that, what the model's being used and how it's being shaped with how it treats a prompt, is something which I hadn't sort of given a lot of thought to around the bias. But yeah, it's really easy to not only to use an unbiased model and turn it into bias and perpetuate that. So
Yeah,
again, it's the
absolutely.
question, what is the model? How is it tuned? How do you deal with prompts? Look.
Yeah. And I think that's that continuing theme through this discussion of just be aware that this is possible. And while this is new technology, in some ways it's just an extension of existing risks and challenges. So you touched on, misleading data. There's a reason, the saying is lies, lies, and damn statistics. There's a whole science around how to make graphs look, tell a certain story, whether you're playing around with the axis or the data points or, political advisors know how to do that best, but it's not just graphs, it's survey responses as well. You can tweak questions in certain ways to always get the answer you want. So just be aware that this technology
Actually,
has the same challenges.
just on that point, I built a GPT this week by uploading all of the Sensitive for the Edge publications, and said, and but we've tuned it to say, answer it in the way that Center for the Edge thinks. And I was finding it was too biased to generically thinking, not the sort of notion of Center for the Edge is interesting stuff is often happening on the fringes, and it will tend to become mainstream. So, and it's not always technology driven. It's a sort of combination of technology, society, context, and environment. So again, it was like I was trying to make it notionally biased to like, I want the, when somebody asks questions, I want it infused with a different way of looking at the world. Now, is that biased? In a form, yeah, it's got a bias towards a different way of thinking about the world. But again, as I say, it was a bit too biased to like, engage your team culture, create a leadership vision, like the standard stuff that we've heard forever. But again, Center for the Edge, like looking at the edges and seeing alternate ways of doing stuff.
Yeah, and it is funny as well. That almost reminds you of that old joke where, as a programmer, you spend 8 hours trying to automate a 1 hour task instead of just spending the 8 hours doing the one-off task manually. So horses for courses, depending on your use case and what you need the technology for. And just naturally throughout the conversation, we've already talked about a lot of the risks and the dangers created by AI. And that's where people's heads will go when there's something scary and unknown. But what do you think are some of the biggest opportunities for government agencies in using AI in areas that maybe don't get a lot of attention?
I think it's things like, let's take submissions and inputs. So we're often getting submissions and inputs from, the usual suspects. And so we could actually go out and sort of say, not only are we going to get formal submissions, but let's go out and, see what people are saying about this in different forums, or, go and ingest community newspapers. And your ability to ingest that and start to say, well, what's the theme? What's happening there? The ability to pull data sets and then, throw them into Code Interpreter or Advanced Data Analysis, as it's called in ChatGPT-4 now. And, tell me what you see in that data. So I see it, the opportunity not to just to sort of rethink the way we do things, that rethink the language we use. But then the other one is, and we're starting to see it a bit more with data, is where systems that we use for data and reporting tend to be like, here's a dashboard, and like, oh yeah. Well, actually, add some a large language model to it and tell the person, like, hey, this is an exception in this data, and this is what we think is going on. And here's a few suggested questions you might ask, or here's a question you can ask yourself. And we've been doing some work with Tableau, and it's called Tableau GPT. And I've sort of looked at it and thought, one of the things I see with, say, dashboards and things that people use, we don't people often people are blind to them because that they're not working in a data-driven world. This is a way we're able to sort of entwine and design data into jobs, but in a context, and actually get people to see beyond what the dashboard's saying. What's underneath that? Is there some instance or occurrence that needs to be thought about? So I think our ability to sort of interact with data, to understand things more simply, to be able to get a better sense of, what's going out there in public land. People say to me, what's the use case? And I sort of say, well, generative AI can have a use case across everything you do. You just, like I used to say with digital, apply a digital lens to that activity and then think, how might we do it with generative AI? And then think about, actually, if we were using generative AI, would we do it in a completely different way? Because we don't have to still do it the same old way. So again, you might say, well, I've got my government website, but right next to it's going to be my little generative AI bot. And people are talking to it instead of saying, go find web page and click here or that. Well, the other one I'm seeing, or I'm doing with my startup, is where instead of getting people to fill in forms, we have a conversation, fill the form in for them, and then say, hey, here's the form based on what we've discussed. Are you happy with that? Yes.
I think as well with all that, there's such an opportunity here to break down a lot of barriers. So I loved your example earlier of if you could get context specific information in Vietnamese for exactly what you need, how wonderful is that? But I think that other opportunity for the public sector is to, reimagine doing things differently and to break down those barriers that have already existed. And also the career and workforce opportunities come with that. So you were talking about your career and, the personal computer, didn't do you out of a job. In fact, it created a new job for you and many hundreds and thousands of people around the world. And generative AI is really the same as well with all the different sort of, knowledge sets that are required. But something I find when I'm thinking about the opportunities in that space is, I proudly proclaim I'm not a techie. I'm really good at the things I do, but I don't know the technology very well. I've sort of learnt it to an extent over time. But what happens now is that the playing field for people like me is leveled because I don't need to learn SQL anymore. I can go and work with a generative AI tool that can tell me what code prompts I might need to do more advanced, sophisticated techniques that I could never do otherwise. So there's a whole range of barriers that exist to unlocking the capabilities in the public sector that have traditionally been barred by certain skill sets or certain requirements that you can now overcome by augmenting your workforce and your existing knowledge with those skill sets as well.
Yeah, it's that sort of old phrase, democratization. The other thing is you can sort of I often say to people, say people generative AI, everybody can use PowerPoint, not everybody should.
Yes, many of
So
my
whilst
lecturers.
so whilst you can do, I mean, that SQL query, I saw one the other day where it was quite complex. You had to do multi-layered things and you could just have a conversation with it and come back and say, okay, we get the query that you've asked us to do is this. Is that correct? Yeah, boom. So again, you might come back with a confirmation. But the other thing is, you still, it might mean that we can get software applications and code done so much faster, but there's still those design components. And what we're seeing, say, particularly in worlds like creativity, Canva did a recent report where it's been really adopted strongly by the creative sector, but they're finding it's taking away that whole lot of mundanity and all this sort of post-production work that they did, and means that they can actually be more creative. And we're finding in areas where it's being used a lot, software coding, creative ideas, image generation, video, etc. The feedback is I'm spending a lot less time searching. I'm spending a lot less time sort of correcting and working through the nuance and the quicksand and the detail. And that mundanity, that pain work has been taken away. I feel happier. I'm more productive. And I'm doing more what I was trained to do, instead of that sort of, you know, hack work or data drudgery work that I have to often to do my job. So I think in, you know, things like your own intranet, like I see a lot of intranets and it's like, how do I do an expense claim? Like, well, there's 14,000 results, but I still don't know how. Being able to, you know, just make that whole, the work I do, but also the stuff I have to do about being an employee, expenses or leave or all of that, just make that easy, you know? And so I think there's a whole heap you can do. And I think, you know, using it internally, like you said before, find somewhere safe to experiment, learn by doing, and then say, okay, now that we've got that capability. The other one, I don't think you've touched on it, Christy, but I'm finding the best ideas are coming from the people closest to the work. So,
always.
Yeah. So as a leader, or if you're a senior, you know, public sector person, sort of, again, understand it, but then go and find where the biggest pain points are or the biggest issues that you have to deal with, and get those people closest to the work skilled up, give them access to skills, get them to work together and create sort of I'm encouraging people to create platform environments where they can quickly, you know, prototype up and get little applications done. Not that you're going to necessarily launch into everybody in the world tomorrow, but we learn with them and say, you know what, there's real value there. Let's scale that up.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, with that point, it makes things more fit for purpose as well. So an example that jumps to mind is procurement. Every time there's a scandal or integrity issue, there's a new process step added. So some of our own Grosvenor's research is it generally costs government $80,000 to conduct an $80,000 procurement. So you sort of look at that and that's sort of yes, minister-esque kind of, you know, in its ludicrousness. So if you were able to instead use these tools to streamline that approach and to manage the process so it's better fit for purpose for the complexity of what you're doing, power to you. And then it's, you know, I think your other point that you really brought home there was it's also more fulfilling. If you can do away with that mundanity, how much more enjoyable would work be? So it's not only going to create more jobs and, you know, is doing so at the moment, but they're going to be higher value adding and more fulfilling as a result. So
yeah,
lots to think about there. I guess lastly then, Pete, if you're working in the public sector and thinking about whether AI could be a useful tool in your area of work, what are one or two of the most important actions you would be taking right now?
So the first action I'd take would be to develop a level of comfort with how to use the tools. So in effect, learn how to be good at prompting. And that could be from training, it could be from experimenting, it could be saying, you know, if you're a leader, I'm going to get my team trained up on effective use of these tools. And it is not just use it like a search term. How do I converse with it? How do I get act in certain roles? How do I get it to change tone? How do I get it to summarize text or data? So learn the sort of the basics. If you looked at it, if it was digital, create a level of generative AI literacy. Understand it, and then the next level is create a level of generative AI utility. This is how we can use it. So I think if you did that stuff, that'd be number one. The next one would be I would look at what are my bigger business problems, and or is there an area that we're doing really clunky and I'm not happy with? And let's say let's run a bit of a prototype hackathon ideas fest with people across your organization to say, how might we fix that? And from that, you'll start to sort of get people know that they've got permission to think. And you'll also find, because what I'm finding is that all of the IT guys, even if they're just doing the normal software support, at home they're building all these weird models and it's like, oh, I didn't even know you could do that. And they're like, oh, this is fantastic. So you've actually got people in your organization. So give them the opportunity to surface what they're doing and then say, okay, How do we move safely?
I'd just add, my own two to add would be governance. So, this is a new technology. How are you going to sort of govern it and manage it and ensure its appropriate use? So some of it is making sure you have a private instance where appropriate, like you talked about, and the sort of, usage approach for that is well set out. But, the sort of principles around auditability and transparency and decision making also need to be thought through in this new world. And with that, something that's my passion is, you've referenced the term human in the loop. I always like human at the center because, human in the loop almost sounds like a compliance box of like, tick, we've done it. We've got Joe there who's checked it over. Great. But no, it's the Joe and Sally and Viet and, Hashana all need to be involved from, design to training data, use and upload to model implementation and refinement to roll out and implementation, and then thinking about those impacted as well, those who the decisions affect. So having the human at the center of all that, I think, taking those things forward, everyone here can be empowered to, go and do something real and practical right now. Thanks, Pete, for such well thought out responses. It's been really enjoyable and it's terrific to have this further conversation and further explore AI and its impacts with you. I hope that those listening, could have even a small slither of your passion imbued, from this conversation into them and go off and do one or two things to make a difference in their world. This podcast follows IPA Victoria's AI and the Future of Governance event that was held in October 2023. The event is one offering within IPA Victoria's Future of Work series and strategic theme, Connection Through Collaboration, New Skills and Celebration. To learn more about what IPA Victoria is doing in this place, please visit our website at vic.ipa.org.au. So that's vicforvictoria.ipaa.org.au. You can also stay in touch with what IPA Victoria does by following it on LinkedIn at IPA Victoria, IPAA Victoria, or on Twitter at IPA Vic. This program's produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I'm Christy Hornby, my guest was Pete Williams, and thanks for listening.